Welcome to the Command Line Podcast for August 7th, 2011. I'm your host, Thomas Command Line Gideon, a self-proclaimed hacker, eccentric, and hacktivist. This is my show about the practice and profession of programming, drawing on well over a decade of professional experience and a lifetime spent hacking, the intersection of technology with society and public policy, and anything else clever, elegant, or funny that catches my mind as a diehard technology geek. This episode is a newscast in which I discuss some of the stories from this past week that caught my attention, including using science fiction to teach computer security, nanocircuits that adhere to any substrate, escaping from infinite loops, and ripping CDs may become legal in the United Kingdom. All of this and more. First, though, I wanted to encourage you, if you haven't already, to consider picking up the latest Humble Indie Bundle, the third such offering. And before I go any further, I just want to say that this is just a heartfelt recommendation on my part based on my experience with these bundles of games from, a fairly interesting distributor with a clever model. I don't get any kickbacks, nor do I have any association or affiliation with any of the game creators or the distributor. All of the included games are DRM-free. That's the first thing that makes them stand out. The next thing is that you can pay what you will and even decide how that gets split between the distributor, the individual game makers, and optional donations to charities like EFF and Child's Play. The suggested price, at least when I bought this third bundle, was set to $25, which I think is really a steal for... initially, they were offering five games. They've added since then two more. And if you actually pay more than the average, which is just a bit over $5, you get an extra bonus. If you don't already have the second Humble Indie Bundle, they'll include that. They'll throw that in as well. I've been sucked into a game that's actually from that second bundle. I realized that I just never got around to playing, called Revenge of the Titans. It's a real-time strategy tower defense game. All of the games from each of the indie bundles so far are cross-platform between Windows, Mac, and Linux, which makes it really easy to run them all, no matter what kind of computer you have. For Linux users like me, the third bundle also includes more of them already in the package formats used by popular distributions like RPMs and deb files. In the past, some of the developers of older titles have even opened up the source of their games contingent on earning a certain goal from the bundle offer specifically. None of these games are comparable to, I think, really, you know, like the blockbusters that are on offer from Hollywood on PCs and consoles, more often fitting into the sort of casual games that maybe you're more familiar with that you can play on a variety of mobile devices, in particular smartphones. I do like that you can scale your price to fit what you value about these bundles, whether that's having a group of small but very well-crafted games, or to support some of the less direct values, like, as I said at the outset, not using DRM, which, in my experience, really only punishes legitimate users. You can check out the bundle page and see if you agree enough to support what I think is a good deal all around. Like many of you, I have a home network and several systems to secure, so I follow reports of security vulnerabilities with special interest. Each week, I pick a couple of those to talk about here, both to cement them in my mind and to raise some awareness. Bruce Schneier linked to an interesting-looking paper written by Tadayoshi Kono of the University of Washington and Brian David Johnson of Intel. They identify a need in teaching security in a computer science curriculum, or an engineering one, to cultivate awareness of societal context, in addition to the usual technical material and skills that forms that usual course of study. In a recent offering, they used science fiction prototyping to that end. The paper documents their experiences in applying this novel approach. The technique of science fiction prototyping was first used at engineering schools. The idea is to explore some design in a wide setting through storytelling. Students are encouraged to support how future users and society might react. As the paper notes, this brings in communication and creative thinking into a course of study that sometimes can lack in the softer, more human-facing aspects. The paper lays out in pretty good detail how the particular class used this technique, including the process deliverables and expectations of what it would help students to develop. Right now, the course the authors designed was intended for senior-level students who had a minimum of introductory courses on relevant technical topics. In their conclusions, they note that storytelling like this could also be useful in a more introductory setting for more junior students or possibly even students seeking degrees other than in computer science or engineering. In general, the idea makes a great deal of sense. Science fiction often starts with the simple question of what if? It encourages a certain suspension of the normal rules to allow internally self-consistent modeling and reasoning about a specific idea. As such, I have to imagine it is very complementary to other notions in security, such as modeling of threats and postulating reasonable defensive responses to hypothetically posed threats. I'd love to see a course like this actually reach out to authors, including those in particular given to also acting as futurists like David Brin, Bruce Sterling, or even Cory Doctorow. Communicating security topics and concerns to a larger audience seems like a possible application of this approach too. Improving the way ordinary users reason about sometimes abstract security risks might be improved considerably through well-told narratives that touch on possible outcomes. Slashdot linked to a Network World piece that described a certain concerning escalation in the payload of mobile malware, in particular targeting Android. A security researcher at Computer Associates spotted and examined a Trojan that can, as it happens, record calls. Previously, similar programs only captured information about those calls, like the numbers and durations, but didn't actually capture any of the call data itself. This bit of badware requires the user to install it, hence it being labeled a Trojan, presenting a dialog that looks pretty close to the usual install screen, apparently. I'm guessing from the description that it replaces the default calling behavior, or receiver, with its own version that handles the call but also records it to the phone's SD card. The researcher found information about a remote server in the malware's config files, suggesting that in the wild it may also be uploading calls, or that a future version of it might start doing so. There are anti-malware packages that can help with this problem. That's the article's main recommendation in terms of protecting yourself or remediating this risk. No doubt Computer Associates also sells such an offering for Android. Common sense around software installation can still help a lot here. If you were not actively looking to set up a new application on your phone, then it is safest to cancel out of anything that looks remotely like an install prompt. There were quite a few articles this past week noting that this year seems like the most active yet for mobile security problems. If you follow any of the trends around smartphone sales, that makes sense. The market, hence the target, the attack surface, is getting much, much larger just by sheer volume. This particular Trojan highlights the new risks that also come with the platform. Much of the malware out there simply ports existing risks of personal data theft, but the exposure of new capabilities, like calling and texting in this case, it's hardly surprising to see new species that are specifically adapted to mobile to latch onto those features and exploit them in some useful way for the attacker. Efforts to use phones for financial transactions through near-field communications in the developed world and a well-established practice of using minutes and more traditional mobile billing in developing nations are likely also making both smart and feature phones increasingly attractive targets to attackers. One attack could capture personal information, thoroughly violate your communications, and even potentially rob you of actual cold hard cash all at the same time. As fatigued as we get thinking about how to stay safe with traditional computers, there needs to be equal incentive for us to develop good safety habits with our phones and really stay on top of it and not get to the point where we're ignoring or just doing things through rote motion. Here are the news stories that caught my eye this week. For more, check out the website at thecommandline.net. Some of the future of computing stories I read deal with new architectures that yield astonishing improvements over existing processors, like quantum computers, or entirely new capabilities that can complement and extend them, such as analog probabilistic processors. A few developments have less to do with the kind or quantity of calculation and more with the very nature of the circuits themselves, whether they're etched in novel materials like graphene are more or less grown from organic molecules like DNA. So new research out of Stanford led by Xiaolang Zheng falls firmly into the latter category. Reading the description at EE Times, I couldn't help but think of temporary tattoos, and you'll understand in a moment perhaps why that came to mind. In this work, circuits are laid down on a reusable silicon wafer insulated with silicon dioxide. A layer of nickel is deposited, followed by an 800 nanometer polymer layer. Then a fairly traditional circuit traces are laid on top of that. The article only mentions a handful of components, including field effect transistors, diodes, and resistors. I infer there are some limits, probably based on scale and complexity. The reason for those constraints may be what makes this particular process so novel. That is that this entire layered affair, when it's soaked in water, the nickel layer comes free from the silicon, yielding flexible circuitry that can then be applied to just about anything. One application in particular is incredibly promising, attaching the circuitry to tissues, which could make very effective biomedical sensors. Now, do you see why I say this made me think of temporary tattoos? Better than that childhood mainstay, the circuits can actually be removed intact rather than being left to deteriorate and fade away. Biomedical devices based on this technique could be reused. They could be removed and reapplied as needed. The multiple use nature, together with the fact that the detachment happens at room temperature, should mean that this process could be put into production pretty quickly. There's nothing in the write-up that hints at any exotic materials or requirements in following this vein of research. The article mentions several other potential uses, from flexible displays to solar cells. The circuitry produced could be attached to just about anything, and the reusable silicon substrate can be just about any shape, I'm guessing. I initially thought of it as being a flat disk, but the article doesn't say that. And then I realized when the article mentioned that the nanowires are just 2 nanometers long and that there is no real damage from crimping, that meant that the silicon can effectively act as a mold for complex shapes and take whatever form like the target material or item onto which the circuit would ultimately be placed. The ability to mold any number of interesting shapes is what differentiates this approach from several similar ones I've seen recently. It has been possible to print circuits with something like an inkjet printer for a while, and I even saw recently some that could be drawn with a pen. I imagine the metallic ink pen could probably be used to draw on more complex surfaces, but the Stanford process is at a much finer scale, similar to traditional means. I can't wait to see what sorts of novel applications this enables beyond those mentioned in the article, including improvements on any number of more traditional 3D and flexible circuits. I've read about wireless networking using light before. Infrared has been used to good effect for some time, although I guess I would hesitate to call the most common implementations actual networking. It's mostly been applied for short distance where minimal bandwidth is required. The earlier work beyond infrared that really I think could be described as a network at Pennsylvania State from over a year ago used a laser diode that they claimed to have been able to achieve 1 gigabit per second or more. The approach was limited by absorption of the light and the cost of the gear involved. I'm uncertain whether optical wireless suffers from the same interference as radio frequency, one reason why it might be more attractive, but certainly optical and RF devices could coexist within the same space without clobbering each other, operating in such different areas of the EM spectrum. Slashdot this past week linked to another ISP review article that was the outlet that covered the Pennsylvania State work about some further developments in the same vein of using light for kind of local area networking. Researchers at Fraunhofer, specifically their telecommunications group, were able to achieve a respectable 800 megabits per second using visible light this time and from a cheap and commonly accessible source, LED light bulbs. Undoubtedly, this network has some of the same limitations as the laser diode-driven one, but may be more cost-effective, enough so to improve the appeal despite the drawbacks. given how light diffuses, I'm not so sure simple obstructions like someone's hand or just their body walking in front of a bulb are a problem. If you think about the kind of soft lighting effects that you get with your typical lamps and whatnot, you don't get, you know, sharp obstructions like an astronomical eclipse or something like that. It really cuts the amount of ambient light. Well, there may not need to be direct line of sight as with a laser system relying on just generalized lighting. There does need to be an absence of too much obstruction. Unlike an RF-based network, which is attractive and has been attractive and commercially developed and exploited, specifically because it can penetrate structures to varying degrees dependent on the frequencies involved. The coverage for the light bulb-based system is pretty limited, as the article notes, to about 10 square meters. Data is encoded by actually toggling the bulbs on and off very rapidly, so rapidly that apparently the human eye can't perceive it. So you can banish any kind of images in your head of sitting in a room with the lights flickering as if they're on the blink. The extra components to do this encoding, mostly a modulator, are themselves also pretty cheap. I know the local Hack DC crew has already tried something similar with laser pointers, optical sensors, some sound gear, and laptops at essentially no cost, just things that they had on hand. They didn't have anywhere near the success as the Fraunhofer researchers, but I can still see a DIY approach that could be made to work on the cheap now that this idea has been proved out. Mostly the work is that it's a proof of a concept that visible light could be harnessed to achieve data transmission rates very competitive to radio frequency. Like IRDA, when it was popular, I could see using a system like this as a complement to the traditional unregulated wireless gear in use everywhere. Not that it would be inherently secure in any way, but the fact that most folks are accustomed to looking for Wi-Fi or cell signals means that a few savvy makers could cobble together a network that would hide more or less in plain sight, at least in those initial stages. Eventually, people might tweak to that, and then that obscurity, which really isn't any kind of security, would fall away. But it's kind of, a clever notional way of at least initially implementing a disguised sort of back channel. I wonder if the usefulness of this technique could benefit from repeaters in the same way that range and reliability of Wi-Fi can be improved. Unlike infrared or laser-based systems, I could easily see a simple wall plug device that could turn each lamp in a room into such a repeating amplifying device. Better yet, what about coupling this with mesh networking so that you could light your room and relay traffic at the same time? Maybe the self-healing properties of mesh could make the absorption and blocking less noticeable than if the visible light gear was deployed in the more usual hub-and-spoke configuration. Shifting from the speculative and the not entirely practical to the dearly useful, Slashdot linked to a press release from MIT. Researchers at the college's Computer Science and Artificial Intelligence Lab, CSAIL, presented a new software tool at the European Conference on Object-Oriented Programming. Called a defibrillator for stalled software in the press release, computer science professor Martin Renard and his graduate students Michael Carbon, Sasa Miselovich, and Michael Kling developed a framework called Jolt that uses a heuristic approach to determine whether some program is stuck in an infinite loop. The cardinal rule of loops in programming is that they must always have an exit condition. Any number of mistakes prevent this from being the case, the most common being a coder changing the value of a variable used to figure out that exit condition, preventing it from ever being true. That sounds like a simple situation to check, but bear in mind that there may be multiple levels of indirection and side effects that may make such an error hard to spot. Though the press release doesn't mention it, perfectly figuring out whether a program halts or not is one of the hardest problems of computer science, one first identified by Alan Turing himself. Instead, Jolt makes a rough judgment when the user suspects a program is stuck. After being launched, it takes a series of snapshots of the program's state in memory. If each member of that series is identical, then the likelihood of an infinite loop is judged to be high. To do anything useful, the program in question has to be compiled with a special compiler. Based on the low-level VM, LLVM, Jolt's compiler marks the beginnings and ends of loops. If it detects a suspected unending cycle of repeated states in a running program, it allows the user to force program execution to the next instruction after the end of the current loop in which the code appears to be stuck. There are a few drawbacks to this approach, the first being software has to be compiled specially to take advantage of what Jolt has to offer. The instrumentation to support a forced exit from a loop impacts the efficiency of a program compiled this way by as much as 7 to 8%. Jolt is also not perfect, but it doesn't have to be since it's used as a sort of an escape hatch when something else has already gone wrong. Users fire it up when they suspect their word processor or spreadsheet or whatever program they're using has virtually gone out to lunch, and the alternative is to kill off the process entirely and then hence losing any work that hasn't been saved. In many cases, as many as 5 different applications during its research and development, Jolt allowed the users to unstick things enough to save their work and then cleanly close the software down. In a quote from Professor Weimer from the University of Virginia, Professor Bernard's decade and a half of work so far was identified as having all very much been in this sort of practical vein. When programs cannot be made provably correct, he's worked to find ways to make them more resilient in the face of real-world errors in everyday conditions. To overcome the requirement of a special compiler to make this a bit more attractive and hence maybe see more adoption in software out in the wide world, the team has been working on a dynamic version that operates on unmodified binaries as they are, called Bolt. Binary Jolt, the runtime version isn't as effective at finding the next safest instruction, having no access to the structure and hints from the original source code and what it can provide. Early results are promising, though, and the release reminds us that the alternative to an imperfectly jumping Bolt is a forced halt that loses program state. So even a bad jump or having to make multiple guesses against the binary version without any advanced knowledge clearly is preferable. It's not clear from the release or the paper covering the work if it will be made available as open source or turned over to the transfer office at MIT for commercialization. In either case, it would most likely show up in end-user software as part of existing OS facilities. Almost all have the notion of a task or process manager that allows users to review the state of running programs and forcibly end them. It isn't hard to imagine Bolt seamlessly added in as an unstick option alongside the existing kill. I linked a bit ago on the website to Boot to Gecko, Mozilla's idea for a mobile OS operating system. Glenn Moody, in his analysis of this, called it Mozilla's next Firefox moment. He was thinking specifically of the way that Firefox has spurred browser development when previously the dominant player, Microsoft, was content to largely stand still. More importantly, Firefox reignited innovation and competition in this space, not through more proprietary development, but with a commitment to open standards. Slashdot linked to a post that suggests experimenting with a mobile platform may just be one idea in a series of new concepts Mozilla may be trying beyond the browser. Chief Lizard Wrangler Mitchell Baker, on her blog, wrote about a vision of an open internet platform, a platform for living online. Baker points to two areas she thinks the organization should address. She's singing to the choir here, at least to me, as these are personal identity and personal information management. I've been saying we need open, interoperable, and standards-based tools for these for years, specifically in the context of a more federated social web. I'm glad to see Mozilla agreeing and finally looking into what has been missing in this space. The implication is that identity and info management are keys to self-determination online. Baker calls this user sovereignty, and it actually is a continuous with Mozilla's values in practice, which put the user first in their software development, first and foremost, and is why I'm pretty much a Firefox fanboy. Implied in her post is that the browser and rendering engine have limits, that pushing them into these new areas may not make as much sense, that these would have to be maybe wholly new undertakings. Baker preempts concerns that expanding Mozilla's focus in this way may undermine existing efforts. Complementary offerings could extend the reach of the open philosophy for user sovereignty. There's also a clear halo effect that users who first contact these new projects may be more likely to give existing programs a try if they hadn't previously been aware of Firefox, Thunderbird, etc. Conversely, those of us already using Firefox and the Gecko rendering engine may prefer using new code from a known and proven player, an outfit that is very much native to the open web. She discusses iOS a bit, how, as compelling as mobile Firefox may be, it's far from enough to get committed owners of Apple's mobile devices to switch to other platforms. This context has arisen before and remains with us in the choices around supporting Windows back in the day. Mozilla opted to support all major platforms to, Baker says, to take their values where people live. This is another reason why I'm such a fan, despite some of the newer open source offerings that have come out there, that this much more inclusive and a practical take on openness is what Mozilla is putting forward here, very specifically from the leadership of that organization. While I've made my own decision to use only open source where possible, and even to prefer free software beyond that when I can, I temper that attitude when discussing choices with other people. I'm trying to talk about it just in terms of informed choices, what benefits openness yields in comparison to proprietary software. Mozilla's software makes it very easy to recommend a good choice, no matter what your environment, and I'm thrilled to realize that this was very, very intentional. It's a good way of incrementally exploring the space of what open source has to offer without having to tackle too many learning curves all at once. Baker's post also puts Boot to Gecko in a larger context, that is the values where people live approach for the current surge, specifically in mobile computing. There have been a lot of experiments at Mozilla, Firefox being one of the earliest and certainly the most successful. Many more never really progressed beyond the initial stages, like Ubiquity, which I really enjoyed, and Raindrop, which I had hoped in terms of social aggregation that it might solve a lot of the problems I have that I talked about in my recent Social Spaces 3 monologue that are still present, managing multiple streams in inbound and outgoing. I do not doubt that Mozilla can brainstorm and come up with some immensely creative ideas, ones that reach well beyond the established technologies they already offer and use. The priority here, though, is clear to do much more than experiment and see what sticks. That being said, there aren't any firm plans outlined in the post, but the organization has made some incredibly difficult changes in direction and management lately, the most notable being the newer, faster, more ambitious release cycle for its flagship Firefox. I hope that optimism, smarts, and experience translates to some durable success executing what is clearly more of an update to Mozilla's mission statement than a clear roadmap of what the titular platform for an internet life may actually involve. Some of the stories that catch my attention during the week are actually continuations of stories or themes that I've discussed before. I like to set aside a little extra time to go over those and follow up. Glenn Moody was one of several people to note the recent work of Phil Bradley using the FOI, or Freedom of Information, facilitating site in the UK, whatdotheyknow.com. What Bradley's request reveals is that the main proponent of the Digital Economy Act, Lord Mandelson, was also largely responsible for how that bill was rushed to get it to pass into law. That was beyond the controversies about how this was a really crummy bit of policy work. There was a larger controversy about how it was just really rammed down the British public's throat. Moody links to Mark Gudge and Torrent Freak for more in-depth analysis if you're curious. Their write-ups of the emails and memos that Bradley uncovered show a fever pitch panic on the part of big content. What is appalling is how directly that translated into Mandelson's actions at the expense of any public debate, let alone public interest. However you feel about copyright, as long as it stands in some legislative form, it operates best as a compromise between the interests of creators, intermediaries, and the public to whom ultimately all cultural ownership resides. Each party to that compromise needs to have an appropriate say and ideally commensurate consideration in the end. Such a massively lopsided bit of policy seriously calls into doubt its legitimacy under any form of government that makes any claims to democracy. All is not bad news from Britain and in relation to the Digital Economy Act. A Slashdot link to a PC Pro post, one of many sharing some good news about the state of copyright in that nation with regards to the realm of digital media. Business Secretary Vince Cable seems to be taking the recent Hargreaves report that I've discussed on this podcast very much to heart. Public domain scholar Jamie Boyle, you'll remember, contributed to this report that ultimately suggested a considerable economic benefit in copyright limitations and exceptions, and also had a pretty good criticism of what it called lobbynomics. Acting on that warm reception to the Hargreaves report, Cable is set to announce a legal status for format-shifting digital media. It's a bit unclear how ripping CDs, which don't have any kind of DRM typically, is a problem, other than perhaps the very strict interpretation of copyright as a right to exclude any kind of copying. So far, industry in the UK and elsewhere hasn't gone after ripping in and of itself, even though they rarely will concede that it's okay. As undoubtedly, really, a lot of what's going on here, the bulk of this kind of ripping is entirely for personal use. So I think it's maybe they classify it as forgivable if still not legal. This would definitely change that, so there's no real kind of ambiguity here. Cable is also apparently set to share plans to drop the website blocking provisions that were proposed under the Digital Economy Act, undoing some of the harm wrought by that bill and its passage. I'm eager to see how all of this plays out, how industry reacts, as always, as it may prove a good example if Cable is able to make these stand up to use in trying to halt, say, domain seizures here in the U.S. That's going to do it for this episode. As always, I want to thank you for listening, and if you enjoy the program, please do tell a friend. Or go to the website at thecommandline.net and click on the support link for all the ways you can financially help out with the production of the show. If you have a question, suggestion, or correction, you can send those to feedback at thecommandline.net, or you can post those as a comment up on the website. If you're away from your computer and the internet at the moment, call the listener comment line at area code 240-949-2638. If you need to get in touch with me securely, details of my public key pair can be found at thecommandline.net/gnupg-fingerprints. The next show should go out in the feed Wednesday night as usual, and if all goes to plan, it should be a bit of event audio from DEF CON that's taking place right now. So until then, don't forget to hack your world. I would like to thank the Internet Archive for media hosting and bandwidth. The views expressed on this program are my own, and where applicable, those of my guests, and in no way reflect those of my employer or anyone else. This show is produced from 100% recycled bits. Except where noted, permission to recycle those further is granted under the Creative Commons Attribution ShareAlike 3.0 United States license. That means you're free to change this show as much as you like, as long as you don't alter credits and you share your changes under the same license.